So we're continuing our series in Matthew chapter 12. It was a few weeks since we were last in Matthew. Dan was actually preaching for us a few weeks ago in Matthew chapter 11. And after this morning's service, when we come to the end of our series in Genesis, I spoke to a few people afterwards, and just saying, kind of reinforcing how we, as evangelical, Bible-believing Christians, how we are viewed by society. And it might cause us to think, well, what is the world coming to? Maybe you've asked that yourself. What is the world coming to? Another question, where is the world heading? Where's the world heading? Climate catastrophes, asteroid impacts, nuclear Armageddon. Well, not according to the Bible. Especially if you're a Christian, actually, we've done our series in Genesis, and actually what we saw there, the very first week in the Bible, tells us as Christians what is coming up ahead. In Genesis, we read, God made the world in 6 days and rested on the seventh. So where's the world heading? Well, if we're Christians, the world is actually heading for rest. If I ask you, well, what's your future? Where are you heading? Rest should be our answer as Christians. And the way we think about rest, perhaps we need to change what our thinking of rest is to be more like the biblical sense. We perhaps think of rest as having our day off. We perhaps think of rest as the holiday that we're planning. We think about that physical rest, don't we? But rest in the Bible is more than just time off. Rest in the Bible is more than just putting your feet up in front of the telly. Biblical rest is something far more profound. Biblical rest is it's far more than that. The English word that we have for rest doesn't really portray the way the Bible talks about rest. Rest, real rest, biblical rest, sums up everything that we were made for. Biblical rest sums up everything that we were made for. And to see that, we need to go right back to the beginning of our Bibles. We should know from our series in Genesis, we were told that God made the world and rested on the seventh day. In a sense, the goal of creation was this rest. We were made, and we see then in Genesis as well, that we were made and we were meant to share in God's rest. And we saw that the proper biblical rest before the fall, we see in Genesis chapter 2, before the fall we see Adam and Eve enjoying God's good world, enjoying this good relationship, a perfect relationship with each other and a perfect relationship with God, knowing Him, knowing His blessing and experiencing His love. That is, in a sense, experiencing this rest that we were made for. And that rest was lost, wasn't it? Through the fall, through failure, from not listening to God's word, through disobedience. And as a result, we've become restless people in a restless place. And that continues today. And when we face trial, when we face suffering, we always feel, it shouldn't be like this. This is not what it was meant to be like. And that's true. We feel a bit like fish out of water because we were made for rest, but we've lost that rest. A rest that we've longed for. And many of you know that my parents run a bunkhouse in Carmarthenshire. A few of the youth have been there. And before they moved there, we were living in Kent. And my mum would talk to me when we were in Kent about this word called hiraeth. Hiraeth, this Welsh word. And it's not got this really any kind of direct English equivalent of translation, but she was explaining it to me as a mixture of longing, of yearning to come back home. For us, that was coming back home to Wales. So when we came back home to Wales as a family, Mum and Dad had no hesitation when they were opening up this new bunkhouse and that they wanted to call this bunkhouse Hiraeth. And that can picture for us something else, actually. Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones says this, "It's difficult to define Hiraeth. For me, it's the consciousness of a man being out his home area, which is dear to him. Like a Christian yearning for heaven." And we should have this yearning, this longing, this hiraeth, as it were, for rest. this longing for this rest, this biblical rest. I'm sure every single one of us has experienced that. But as we look for other things, don't we, in order to provide that rest. The world looks for other things in order to provide that rest. We reach up for rest, yearning for something that will make life easier, to make life special. But actually, it turns out it just causes restlessness, not rest. Even religion can cause restlessness. And that restlessness can come into the church doors, in here. Rituals, tradition can become part of this restlessness, where we think some routine that we do here in church, some tradition that we do here in church can become so important, even though there's no mention of it in the Bible. It can become so important because it's just the way we do things. Even people can think that the way we do things will provide this rest, but it's actually restlessness. For example, the order of the service, the format of the service, is very important to some people. And if we change it, we'll be in trouble. I've been in churches where the order of service has literally been laminated and stapled up the front. And if I strayed off that, I'd be in real trouble. And for instance, I was told by a lecturer in college that he helped out with a church in Northern England to help out this struggling church. And there was an organist there. He'd been playing the organ for years and he absolutely loved it. But then my lecturer was going to ask him to stop playing just for a while. And the organist's daughter approached my lecturer and said, "Please, please don't stop him playing the organ. It will break him. He lives to play that organ." And my lecturer said, "That's precisely why I'm asking him to stop. If we're living for anything or anyone other than Christ, something's desperately wrong." That's what my lecturer said. This man lived to play the organ. He wasn't living for Christ. It's not that playing the organ's wrong. It's great that we have music here in church. That's a gift. But often we can make a good thing an ultimate thing. We can make a good thing like playing the organ the ultimate thing. And actually we think that that will provide rest. But actually it causes restlessness. So as we get into the text here, why on earth are we talking about rest? Where's that in the text? Well, look down at verse 1. It says, "At that time." Okay, let's stop there. At that time. So what we're looking at is at that time, it's closely linked to what we've seen before. So when Dan was preaching a few weeks back, it immediately flows from what we read in chapter 11, verse 25 to 30, which is why Bryn read that. So we need to remember what Jesus said there. Look down at verse 28. "Come to me, all who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. My yoke is easy and my burden is light." So we go from these heartfelt, passionate words from Jesus to going and looking at this kind of theological disagreement with the Pharisees here. But we always need to remember what Jesus said there in verses 25 to 30. And what we see is, I haven't got any points tonight, there's this one main thrust that I want to look at throughout this. So we're just going to look at the story. And Jesus' disciples, they're just going for a casual stroll on the Sabbath. Many of you like a Sunday afternoon walk. And that's basically what's going on here. Their Sabbath was Saturday, not Sunday. But what the disciples are doing, we read that they're hungry, verse 1. So they grab a few ears of corn, rub it in their hands to rub off the husks, and pop them in their mouths for a snack. And if you remember what we were doing in home group a few weeks back in the Ten Commandments on stealing, you'd hopefully remember this isn't classed as stealing. This was lawful thing to do, and this wasn't considered stealing, but it still annoyed the Pharisees from what we see there in verse 2. They considered this a forbidden thing to do by their own standards, and a forbidden thing to do on the Sabbath. So verse 2, they say, "Look, your disciples are doing what is unlawful on the Sabbath." Look at this restlessness stirred within them. And let's be honest, we all have our preconceived ideas of the Pharisees, which is a shame, really. But if we were around then, we would probably consider the Pharisees to be quite good people. And even though they got it completely wrong, we couldn't doubt their devotion to God in the sense of how much they tried to devote their lives to God. They were upright, law-abiding people. And they're people who demanded respect. Definitely someone who wouldn't really mind being your neighbour. They'll probably keep the noise down. But the time we get to the end of the passage here, verse 14, they're plotting how to kill Jesus. Now, that wasn't the typical response that the Pharisees had when someone disagreed with them. It seemed as though actually they quite liked a good old theological debate. But there was something so outrageous about what Jesus said here that they wanted him dead. There was something so outrageous, something that so threatened or challenged everything that the Pharisees held dear. And there's got to be more than going on whether it's right or wrong to pick ears of corn on the Sabbath. Their extreme reaction, it links to an extreme claim from Jesus. So the big issue seems to be that link that we've looked at from last time, verse 28 to 30, this issue of rest. And as we've seen, the biblical idea of rest, the reason why it's important, biblical rest sums up everything that we were made for. It stems back from Genesis. And therefore, when sin entered the world, in the Old Testament, the Sabbath was given for the Old Testament people of God to remember what it used to be like, to remember Eden, for them to remember what we were made for. Like Eden, we were made to know God, to serve him, to enjoy him. So their Sabbath rest in the Old Testament was to look back and remember that rest that we had in Eden, but also to look forward to the rest that God will provide in the future. That was the Old Testament Sabbath. That was the heart of it. And last time in Matthew, we saw with Dan, Jesus made this staggering claim in verses 28 to 30. He said, that rest that you've been waiting for, that rest that you've longed for, that rest you've tried to find in other things, Jesus said, that rest is ultimately found in me. That's the claim we see Jesus make in verse 28. Everything the Sabbath pointed towards was to be found in Jesus. Now, saying that can provoke two reactions. We could see that as a massive comfort, or we can see that as a challenge. I don't know what you think, but the Pharisees definitely saw that as a challenge. And we've been doing the Ten Commandments, haven't we? We got to the fourth commandment, which was the Sabbath commandment. And when you read that in Exodus 20, you would have seen that that was by far the longest commandment given. It's definitely in more detail than any of the other commandments. And presumably it's written that way so the commandment wouldn't be misunderstood. Yet that's exactly what the Pharisees did. It's exactly what the Pharisees did. They had their own writings and they added hundreds and hundreds of pages of their own writings of what they thought the Sabbath meant. For instance, this was written in their extra biblical books. For instance, when someone got ill on the Sabbath, a doctor could go and see them to make sure they didn't get any worse, but they weren't allowed to make that person any better, because then that would be considered work. And also, they considered harvesting work, which is why the Pharisees were so annoyed here. They considered the disciples here, when they were picking up the corn, rubbing off the husk in their hand and popping it in their mouths, they considered, well, they're harvesting on the Sabbath. That's work. Therefore, that's wrong. And we probably have got enough Bible knowledge to realise that the Pharisees aren't exactly the good guys in Scripture. We kind of know that when they come onto the scene, we can boo and hiss at them. That's a shame, really, because we have these preconceived ideas, because I think actually they represent for us what many of our natural instincts might be when it comes to religion. For them, rest was found in keeping rules rather than knowing Jesus. Actually, and that can expose a lot of areas for us. Even if we're committed Christians, our Christian life can quickly slip into this restless, counterfeit Christianity about keeping rules close rather than keeping Jesus close. We can lose focus so easily. And maybe for you, you think, well, rest, this biblical rest, surely that is just something that we achieve when we actually just get to heaven. We don't experience that now. When heaven is achieved by keeping rules, being good, observing rituals like going to church, hymn singing, wearing the right clothes, saying the proper things, or whatever it might be. That's when we experience rest when we get to heaven. But what this passage is screaming out from its pages is rest is not found by keeping rules. It is only found by knowing Jesus. That's the point. And to do that, Jesus answers the Pharisees' claim there in verses 3-8. And I don't know about you, but Jesus doesn't reply how we might reply to the Pharisees. He doesn't say, oh, come on, Pharisees, get real. The disciples aren't working. This isn't work for them. Their normal employment isn't farming. They're just picking a few ears of corn. Stop being ridiculous. Well, Jesus doesn't say that. But what he does say, in effect, is you've missed the whole point of the Sabbath because you've missed me. You failed to recognize me, Jesus is saying. And as he says that, he points out in verses 3 and 4. If you look down at that, he answers, haven't you read what David did when he and his companions were hungry? He entered the house of God, and he and his companions ate the consecrated bread, which was not lawful for them to do, but only the priests. This takes us back to 1 Samuel 21, where David is basically a fugitive along with his men. They're on the run from King Saul, and they're in danger. They're starving. And David turns to this priest for help and asks for food. However, the only thing at hand was some bread, which wasn't for David and his men, it was for the priests. It would have been put in the temple the week before, and after that week's been, probably the bread was a little stale, but the priests were to take it out, and the bread was only for the priests. But it wasn't lawful for David to take it. He wasn't a priest, yet he does take it and give some to his men. And even though it wasn't lawful for David to do that, he's not condemned for doing it. And the Pharisees, considering who King David was, he was like one of the pillars, in a sense, of their Jewish history. The Pharisees would have never condemned King David. And what Jesus is saying is, well, you haven't condemned King David. Therefore, do not condemn me, because I'm greater than David. And it goes on. It goes on to an even more extraordinary claim. Jesus isn't just saying he's greater than David. It goes on, if you look down at verse 6. I tell you that something greater than the temple is here. So Jesus is saying he's greater than David. He's now saying he's greater than the temple. Hold on. Really? The temple. The temple, the place where God himself made himself present with his people, where God ruled over them, where God blessed his people. Well, Jesus is saying, can't you see, God's presence, God's rule, and God's blessing is now found in a far more real, far more profound, deeper way in me. And that's a huge claim. That's a huge claim. And that these extraordinary claims keep on going. The third thing that Jesus says is in verses 7 and 8. He quotes Hosea 6, verse 6 there. It says, if he had known what these words mean, I desire mercy and not sacrifice, he would have not condemned the innocent. Jesus and his disciples were innocent, and he quotes Hosea chapter 6, verse 6. And it's the second time that Jesus has quoted that in Matthew's gospel. He quotes it in chapter 9. And the first time he uses it, he says this, I want mercy and not sacrifice, for I did not come to call the righteous, but the sinners. Jesus is saying, it's not about keeping the letter of the law. It's not about rule keeping. He's saying, verse 7, we can see, he's saying to the Pharisees, your religious rule keeping has made you hard-hearted, harsh, and hypocritical. And God's not like that. God's the opposite. God's not harsh, but merciful. And we'll see more of that in a second. But and we see here Jesus making another huge claim, the last huge claim that we'll be looking at, verse 8. He says, "For the Son of Man," one of the titles that Jesus called himself, "the Son of Man is the Lord of the Sabbath." He's not just simply saying to the Pharisees here, "I know a bit more of my Bible than you do." He's saying, "I know the Sabbath perfectly and completely because I'm the Lord of the Sabbath. Because I'm equal with God." And that means that the whole of the Sabbath is about Jesus. It's all for him. It's all fulfilled in him. David, the temple, the Sabbath are all fulfilled in Jesus. All that Sabbath spoke in terms of rest, the rest that would be coming, is fulfilled in Christ. The rest that we were made for. Jesus says we find that in him. So the way that we keep that Sabbath command today means that we come to Jesus. The way we keep the Sabbath command means that we come, he says, "Come to me, all who are weary and burdened, I will give you rest." We obey the Sabbath command now by going to Christ, by going to Jesus, being with him, coming to Jesus. And by doing that, we might know what the true Sabbath rest is. So from all these claims, extraordinary claims, we can see, surely, why the Pharisees were so angry. It's not about whether it's right or wrong to go shopping on a Sunday. It's about these huge claims that Jesus is making. Jesus is claiming that the one way that you are right with God is not by rule-keeping, but by going to Jesus alone. Until you submit to Jesus, you will never know God. We saw that last time. If you look down at chapter 11, verse 27, it says, "No one knows the Father except the Son." That's a massive claim for the Pharisees. That's also a huge claim for us now. The only way that we can know God himself is through Jesus. We saw that, didn't we, a few weeks ago with our hot potato evening. Is Jesus the only way to God? Yes. Absolutely. The only way we can know God is through Jesus. And he says, "Come to me and I will give you rest." And obviously the Pharisees didn't like that one bit. And it turned their work-based religion completely on its head. So they set up a situation to try and discredit him. The scene moves on there from verses 9 to 14. And they set up this situation, man with the shriveled hands, whether the Pharisees placed him there or not, I'm sure they did, to try and set this situation up. And verses 9 and 10. "Going from that place, he went to their synagogues, and a man with a shriveled hand was there, looking for a reason to bring charges against Jesus. And they asked him, 'Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath?'" I thought that was interesting. I don't know about you. The Pharisees don't ask Jesus whether he's even able to heal this man. In a sense, they just take that for granted. They don't question Jesus' ability to heal, do they? That never seems to be in doubt. In a sense, they like the miracle, but they don't like what the miracle implies. Like so many times throughout Jesus' life, people want the miracle, but they don't want the miracle worker. So, is it lawful for Jesus to do this or not? Again, by the Pharisee standards, by their kind of their own writings, yes, in exceptional circumstances. Remember, we said earlier, if someone gets ill on the Sabbath, then a doctor could go and see someone to make sure they didn't get any worse, but the doctor was not allowed to make them any better, because then that would count as work. But that's not the situation here, is it? A man, what we see is a man with the shriveled hands. He's had that a while, but that's not urgent. That can wait till tomorrow. And again, how would you respond to the Pharisees here? Again, you're so obsessed with your rules. You've missed the point of the Sabbath. If you look at verses 11 and 12, saying, you treat your sheep better than you treat a fellow human being. Have you seen where your religion has taken you? Heartless and harsh, that you won't even do good on the Sabbath. In Mark's account of the same story, this is the same story, the parallel account in Mark chapter 3. And in Mark chapter 3, verses 4 and 5, it says this. Then Jesus asked them, which is lawful on the Sabbath, to do good or evil, to save life or to kill? But the Pharisees remained silent. So he looked at them in anger and deeply distressed at their stubborn hearts. Has your Christianity been focused on rules, which will only lead to harshness, hard-heartedness, and we saw there, Mark, that distresses God. It deeply distresses God. But God shows mercy. And that's why Jesus heals this man, verse 13. And he said to the man, stretch out your hand. So he stretched it out, and it was completely restored, just as sound as the other. Just as a side, Jesus didn't break any commands. He fulfills the law where we couldn't. Jesus wasn't a medical professional working on his day off. And one commentary said, even from their own point of view, the Pharisees must have found it difficult to call this breaking the Sabbath. Jesus used no remedy, performed no action, simply spoke a word, and the man merely stretched out his hands. And the law itself said nothing about healing on the Sabbath. It did say about doing good on the Sabbath, as we can see there. From verse 12. But from the Pharisees' extra standards, from the Pharisees' own writings, they saw that Jesus was working on the Sabbath and therefore condemned him. And that leads us to verse 14. But the Pharisees went out and plotted how they might kill Jesus. Pharisees, so pathetic in judging someone for picking corn on the Sabbath day, now go to plotting murder on the Sabbath day. And throughout this, Jesus isn't just correcting their understanding and our understanding on what the Sabbath is, but verse 12, therefore it is lawful to do good on the Sabbath. Now the Sabbath's for doing good, for showing mercy, for doing what is right, but it's much, much more, it's much, much deeper than just that. It's where the Sabbath rest is to ultimately be found. And Jesus says that he is the one who can deliver real rest, reverse that curse from Genesis. We're not going to have full, restored bodies, rested bodies this side of heaven, are we? And we're always going to be striving and always struggling. But we can have a restored relationship with God. Now, that can it be experienced now? How can we have that restored, rested relationship with God now? Well, verse 14 takes us there, doesn't it? That Pharisee's plot to kill Jesus, it succeeds. But it's done through God's foreknowledge. It's done through God's planning. And at the crucifixion, we see Jesus take the sin of the world on himself. Sin, the one thing that had spoilt rest for us. Biblical rest, it's not just talking about heaven. Biblical rest is about having Jesus himself, and that can be experienced now. So Jesus confronts the Pharisees then, and he confronts us today. Are you still trusting in your religion? Are you still trusting in your rule-keeping, making sure you've done this or that, but then you've missed Jesus? Are you so focused whether you do this on Sunday or that on Sunday? I'm not trying to pass judgment for what we do on Sunday. What we're trying to see is that actually we can be so focused whether we do this on Sunday or that on Sunday without realizing Jesus says, come to me and I will give you rest. The Sabbath rest that you've been longing for, that you've been yearning for, that heareth longing. It's not about keeping rules, but it's about knowing him. And throughout this, I just want to make sure I'm completely clear. I'm not suggesting that obeying God is not important. Of course it's important. If we're his disciples, we need to follow him. Chapter 11, verse 29 says that, doesn't it? It says, take my yoke upon you and learn from me. We take his yoke. We learn from him. We follow him. But it's not that obedience doesn't matter. It does matter. But we take his yoke, but it's a liberating yoke. It's not like the yoke of religion. It's not like the yoke of the Pharisees. His yoke is easy. It fits. It's what we were made for. A Christianity focused on rules leads to harshness. It's a restless religion. A Christianity focused on Christ leads to grace and mercy and provides rest for our souls. So lastly, it's relationship with Christ that brings rest to our souls tonight, isn't it? And a future promise of rest for our bodies in heaven will come. We can be assured of that. That these fragile old things will one day find rest as well. But the big question remains, will you come to him tonight? Will you come to him tonight? Will you follow him? Will you take your rest in him? And that we might only ever find our rest in him. Amen.